Today on Wings.
I am told Americans are passionate about trade policy these days. What does that really mean, and how should feminists feel about it?
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
I'm Kate Raphael. I've always thought free trade is bad, fair trade is good, but the more I read and listen these days, the less I feel like I understand all these issues. So rather than continuing to spout orthodoxy that I can't really defend, I decided to ask some experts. I'm joined today by two guests. Maria Floro is professor of economics at American University in Washington, D.C., and co-director of the graduate program on gender analysis and economics. She received her B.A. from the University of the Philippines, her M.A. from Monash University in Australia, and her PhD from Stanford. She has collaborated with researchers, women's groups, and community organizations in Thailand, Philippines, Ecuador, and Bolivia, conducting fieldwork on vulnerability, gender, and informal employment in urban poor communities. And we're also joined by Stephanie Seguino, professor of economics at the University of Vermont. Dr. Seguino's research explores the impact of globalization on income distribution and well-being, with emphasis on Asian and Caribbean economies. She's been an advisor to the World Bank, the United Nations Development Program, the Asian Development Bank, and USAID. Dr. Seguino has also contributed her services to local and global living wage campaigns. Thank you both so much for joining us. Let's start at the most basic level. When people talk about trade policy, what are they really talking about? Because nobody thinks that we shouldn't buy and sell things from other countries.
Trade policy regards rules that regulate the movement of goods and services across borders. So oftentimes countries have tariffs on imports. Sometimes they subsidize exports. In fact, the United States is a great subsidizer in agricultural exports. The notion behind trade liberalization is to reduce those tariffs or quantity restrictions of goods and services across borders.
However, let me just add to what Stephanie has said. There's non-tariff barriers, basically hidden subsidies to some exports. For example, if water used by U.S. farmers for agricultural export crops are subsidized by state or federal government, those are not necessarily subject to trade rules. And there's this issue of hidden subsidies.
A lot of people are arguing about what we call free trade. Where did free trade come from?
Actually, free trade is a relatively new phenomenon. In the years in which the United States was industrializing and Europe were industrializing, all of these countries had protectionism. And the reason was that for an industry in a country to catch up with the global leaders often takes practice. It takes time. It takes experience producing. And so as a country produces over time, its productivity rises and industries become more competitive. So this was the norm for the rich countries. In fact, the greatest growers in terms of economic growth in recent years, including South Korea, for example, as well as Taiwan and China, have had significant protectionism. It's only once they became competitive that they took down the trade barriers. And of course, they've been successful because they were given the opportunity to catch up. And so rich countries have kicked away the ladder by pushing for free trade for countries that are not actually able yet to catch up.
The free trade term goes way back to David Ricardo in the early to mid 1800s. And the term, as pointed out by Stephanie, has been actually misused. In practice, there hasn't really been any free trade. Much of the industrialization in developed countries in the last 150 to 200 years have really based on the support provided to the fledgling industries that served as the basis for their industrialization.
When we talk about free trade in North America, the economists who write in places like the New York Times and the Washington Post seem to be split about whether or not NAFTA has cost U.S. jobs. So Bernie Sanders cited research by the Economic Policy Institute, which is a union-funded think tank, which says that the U.S. lost over 800,000 jobs to Mexico because of NAFTA. And PolitiFact and people like Paul Krugman have cited a series of nonpartisan studies, or what they call nonpartisan studies anyway, which they say found that NAFTA has had a neutral impact in terms of U.S. employment, that it's neither cost jobs nor created jobs. It seems to me, as a layperson, like it would be a fairly straightforward thing to figure out, did we lose jobs or didn't we?
Even if the effect was neutral in terms of quantity of jobs, and people come up with different estimations due to the approach to measurement, I'm going to suggest that there's something much worse going on, and it's the impact on wages. NAFTA wasn't just trade liberalization, it was investment liberalization. It allowed U.S. corporations to move to Mexico, which has lower environmental standards and lower labor standards, and less monitoring of the labor standards that exist. So firms could threaten to relocate to Mexico, and in fact, many firms did threaten to leave, but didn't actually have to leave in order to force down wages. So we've seen in the U.S. productivity has increased, but wages have been stagnant and indeed fallen in a number of sectors of the economy, and that has to do with the threat that firms can now move to other countries if, in fact, workers do not concede and accept low wages. And the evidence on that is incontrovertible. There is broad agreement that the wage share of income has declined over this period of time.
One of the things that we hear is that what's been bad for American workers, pushing down wages, the flight of capital and manufacturing jobs from U.S. cities, has been great for workers and economies in the global South. In 2014, a Pew Research poll found that nearly 90% of those they surveyed in the developing world say trade is good for their economies. Is this true or false?
Let me add that in addition to the impact on wages, there's also the impact on the national governments involved in these trade agreements, such as NAFTA, because such trade agreements have been used to impose rules on national governments which favor the foreign firms. The agreement actually starts with an uneven playing field whereby foreign firms that come in are able to extract lower wages or deregulation or exemption from labor laws as well as from environmental regulations. So the quality of jobs that may be brought by trade agreements may not necessarily be good jobs. The jobs can be precarious, contingent, temporary. So there are labor conditions in addition to wages that are impacted by these trade agreements.
Talk about how free trade and the trade policies of the last 20, 25 years have impacted women specifically.
For the most part, developing countries at the initial stage of industrialization tend to take on labor-intensive export industries that rely heavily on female workers. In the Philippines, where I come from, call centers have generated jobs for men and for women. And there have been studies that show that in some cases, conditions of jobs in these export-oriented industries are better than, say, jobs in the non-export-oriented domestic firms, for example, or in the informal sector. That said, I want to mention that this kind of so-called feminization of labor, i.e. export-oriented industrialization, which has brought more jobs and integrated women into the labor market, have a more nuanced impact. In some cases, yes, it has brought better jobs, but it maintains the gender wage gap. It has not closed the gender wage gap. Women are paid less than men. They tend to be at the bottom in factories, for example, in garment factories, say in Bangladesh or in Pakistan or in Cambodia or Vietnam, women tend to be in the rank and file, and you have male supervisors. So the standard sort of gender hierarchy manifests itself. That's one part of the story about, you know, women's participation in the labor market. But there's another aspect, because the way production processes have developed in the last 40, 50 years have made use of the technology, the communication, so that global supply chains and outsourcing have become the norm in many of these industries. So while you may observe some of the core factory workers, say in Vietnam, women, for example, if one have to visit some of these factories, they seem to be okay. They're working in Samsung companies. They are involved in the electronic chip. They wear all these garments and so forth. On the other hand, there are aspects of the global supply chains, export-oriented industries that involve subcontracted workers that are done through middlemen, subcontracting them to different places, for example, in Thailand, in Bangkok, or in the Philippines. And these women are paid in piece rate. They work long hours. There are no regulations by way of safety. So one can, for example, be working in stitching soccer balls, and you can have, for example, fumes coming out from the glue, and there are no regulations on that. So you have very exploitative piece rate wages. You have also lack of regulation, occupational safety and hazard. And these are outside the purview of many of the discussion you have, because they are in what you call the blurred area between formal and informal sector. They are often not monitored and evaluated. They don't have access to benefits, and their rights, workers' rights, are for the most part negligible. Then there's another aspect of this trend towards integrating women vis-a-vis export promotion. The feminization of labor can actually be reversed. Once an industry that has been for the most part labor intensive, rely heavily on female labor, gets mechanized, you then see a shift of the ratio of female to male workers going to the other direction. We see that, for example, in the mechanization of factories in the maquiladora areas in Mexico. You see that also in the Caribbean.
On Wings, you're listening to a discussion about trade, hosted by Kate Raphael of Women's Magazine on Community Radio KPFA in Berkeley, California.
I'm speaking with Dr. Maria Floro, who is professor of economics at American University, and Stephanie Seguino, who is professor of economics at the University of Vermont. One of the things that President Obama has said in response to critics of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Accord, which he's trying to push through, is he said, but these agreements will actually enable us to ensure that workers have rights to organize, that there are some standards, that there is a minimum wage, that there are environmental regulations. What about that?
Well, I think the devil is in the details. And we know, for example, from the NAFTA agreement that included clauses that restricted the ability of the government to regulate the service sector or extended the period of time for pharmaceutical patents. There is not any assurance of monitoring any agreements that are made. One of the things that's happening with these agreements essentially is that they are reducing the ability of national governments to make decisions that influence the quality of economic development and the quality of work conditions and the quality of environment in these countries. In some ways, these trade agreements are undemocratic in that regard, because they force governments to take positions or do things that they ordinarily would not choose to do. I'll just give you one example. Many countries that have grown rapidly, including the industrialized countries as well as the Asian economies, did so by giving supports to their domestic industries so they could develop national capacity in various areas. So 1960, South Korea produced cheap shoes, they produce plywood and wigs. Today, South Korea is one of the most important semiconductor producers in the world. They have their own automobile industry and so forth. Part of that happened through supports to domestic entrepreneurs to develop their industries. And NAFTA and TPP essentially take away the ability of countries to be able to do that. So I think that that's really the problem with these agreements, is what's hidden.
There has been resistance by policymakers, especially the developed countries, and to some extent also even national governments in developing countries, in including a clause about labor standards in any of the trade agreements. In the past several WTO forums, women's organizations and many gender advocacy groups have raised this issue of labor standards, and the same thing also with civil society organizations, labor organizations, in the discussion of trade agreements. And that has always been pulled out of the table. It's non-negotiable. It's not even to be discussed officially in this forum. There's also pressure for developing country governments to weaken collective bargaining so that you have labor unions. While that's been in the decline in the U.S. over the last 50 years, and the trend is happening also in parts of Europe, we see that same trend happening in the developing countries. And part of that has to do with the bilateral, not just regional, but bilateral agreements made by developed countries, including the United States, with a developing country, in trying to weaken make sure that collective bargaining is not going to be a deterrent or detriment to foreign direct investment, to trade agreements. For a developing country which has small budgets or, you know, small government revenues, especially now that you don't have tax revenues coming from tariffs, you have this trade-off. You can either use much of that budget in promoting foreign direct investment and also promoting export industries by providing services and infrastructure that meet their needs, such as better ports, roads that goes to export processing zones, and so on. But as an economist, you know that that means that something has to give in, and it oftentimes the budget that has been allocated to expanding export processing zones, for example, or attracting foreign investment, has been to the detriment of basic services provisioning that affect women, particularly in terms of access to safe water, better sanitation, and access to health services, and so forth and so on. So there are both direct as well as indirect effects of trade agreement, and there are gender dimension on those indirect effects as well.
Another word that has suddenly come into the generalized U.S. lexicon is remittances. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump is, of course, several weeks ago said that if he's elected, he's going to force Mexico to pay for a wall on the border by impounding remittances by Mexican citizens who are illegally in the U.S. or who are in the U.S. without papers. So leaving aside the debate about whether he can do that, what he's talking about is seizing money belonging to Mexican citizens living in the U.S. if they try to send that money home. Now, where did this concept of remittance come from, and what does it mean in the context of trade?
Remittances refer to the income that workers who relocate to another country send back to their families. And many workers who come to the United States or move to other countries do so not because they are really interested in living here, but rather because economic conditions are so bad in their own home country. And, you know, as a macroeconomist, I see those economic conditions largely influenced by policies that have been promoted by the U.S. and the World Bank, in particular in the IMF. So it is the situation is quite ironic in certain ways. So to stem outward migration of workers, in fact, would require a different set of macroeconomic policies that unfortunately the U.S. isn't supporting. But that said, there are many workers who relocate in order to be able to provide for their families. And in some countries, Remittances are a huge portion of GDP, 10, 20, 30% of GDP in some countries. But they essentially, the workers have essentially moved to a different country in order to obtain a job and are sending their income back home just as they would have shared it with their families were they actually able to find a job nearby.
And Professor Floro, my understanding is that in some countries, and specifically the Philippines, that the majority of the people who are leaving the country to work and sending that money back home are women.
I would say in the case of the Philippines, it's a slight majority of the migrant workers, or what we call OFWs, overseas Filipino workers, are women. There is quite a number of male workers, construction workers, for example, and engineers who go to the Middle East or Singapore or Malaysia. But you're right, in the last several decades or so, labor has been one of the major, if not the largest, foreign exchange earning. So basically labor becomes an export commodity. And this goes way back to the martial law years in the 1970s, where the former president Marcos has essentially promoted the export of labor to bring in the hard needed foreign currency during the period, especially in the time of the economic crisis in the early 80s. So what has happened, therefore, is that the inability of developing countries to address employment generation, to address the need for decent employment, not just employment, but decent employment, has made governments take the easy way out. Well, we have all this educated labor force. We have lots of nurses. We have lots of teachers with college education. We can send them abroad. That said, one of the things also that has happened is this increasing demand for care services in many developed countries. That increase in the demand for care has to do with the increasing life expectancy and the aging of the population. And therefore, you have women who are educated, trained sometimes as teachers or as nurses, who find working as a domestic caregiver in Europe or in the Middle East, or in the United States, will bring higher income or bring better wages for them. So you have this sort of movement from the South or developing countries to the North or developed countries of women workers who serve as nannies, who serve as nursing aides in nursing homes, who work in hotel services, in hotels as housekeepers and so forth and so on. Many of these domestic workers, overseas workers, don't see their families except once a year.
Barring world socialist feminist revolution, would it be possible at this point to roll some of this back? I've seen, you know, various opinions about that. And is it possible to have a trade policy that would benefit workers and consumers in both rich and poor countries? Stephanie Seguino, I was interested to read that you have worked on global living wage campaigns. What does that look like?
Well, first of all, I think it is possible. People aren't necessarily opposed to trade for the sake of being opposed to trade. What they're concerned about is that a country's imports, when we do liberalize, are made cheaper based on exploitation of people who are less powerful, whether it is women workers, whether it is the environment, whether it's weak governments that are desperate to create jobs and so forth. And that has been called the race to the bottom, and I think rightfully so. So the question is, how do you encourage trade that's based on firms stepping up and being innovative? Trade rules have to serve the economic development needs of each country. So to have blanket free trade is simply inappropriate in a world in which there is such dramatic inequality between countries. Now, I'll just give you an example. A few years ago, when trade was relaxed, trade liberalization was implemented in a number of countries through the WTO. Asia did well because partly because they have high gender wage gaps, and that was what propelled their low costs of garments. But it utterly destroyed the female-dominated garment sector of Southern Africa. And so the basis of competition has been largely on the backs of disempowered women. So the question is, how do you create trade that is based on firm innovation and not exploitation? And the second is that we have to realize that trade is a tool to an end. It is not an end in itself. And the tool for national governments is to promote livelihoods that allow people to provide for themselves and their families with dignity. So that's going to look different for every country. But unfortunately, the rich countries have used their power to impose free trade on countries in ways that are not necessarily advantageous to those countries. You mentioned Mexico earlier, which had seen a surge in jobs as a result of the trade liberalization with via NAFTA. The reality is that as wages have risen in those countries, those firms have moved to even lower wage countries. So even those gains are temporary, as Professor Floro indicated. So the question is really not free trade. That is not the goal. The goal is, how do we improve living standards? And there are many mechanisms for doing that. One argument has been that there ought to be labor standards, that exploitative work conditions ought not to be able to be used to reduce wages. I think that's actually controversial in developing countries. But one of the things that we might push for is the right to organize, and not only on paper, but in reality, as well as deeper mechanisms to monitor labor standards and environmental standards. I also think that, you know, the reality is that the United States itself has trade barriers and offers trade subsidies in the area of agriculture. So what is good for the goose needs to be good for the gander, and that does not yet exist. Moreover, some of the really problematic problems of these trade agreements aren't really around trade. They're around investment and the right of corporations to be treated similarly to national organizations. Given their economic power, they have disproportionate power and can really thwart development goals of countries. So I don't think this is easy. I don't think I can give you a laundry list, but you know, there of what policies we would adopt. But there are many tools, and what we have to be clear about is what the goal is. The goal is not simply the movement of more goods and services across borders, but rather the improvement of people's livelihoods.
Dr. Stephanie Seguino is professor of economics at the University of Vermont and the author of groundbreaking research on gender equity and globalization. Dr. Maria Floro is co-author of Gender, Development, and Globalization, Economics as If All People Mattered, which is considered the leading primer on global feminist economics and development. She teaches economics at American University. I spoke with both of them by Skype. I'm Kate Raphael.
Thank you, KPFA Women's Magazine, for the use of this interview. You can find Women's Magazine via the webpage kpfa.org. To hear this and other Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or visit our podcasts at rabble.ca or on facebook.com/wingsradio. Our longtime supporters include your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the new book, The Gift in the Heart of Language. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.